Blog Talk Radio.
He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue.
Wake up, Claire! Jim's dead! They're dead! They're all dead!
Babe, I'm gonna kill you faster than a bullet.
Say hello to my little friend!
The Brian De Palma Tribute Show, Sunday, July 22nd at 6 p.m.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, the most popular movie talk radio show on the internet. Tonight, the Movie Geeks start the celebration of director Brian De Palma a little early when they interview film critic and De Palma devotee Keith Ulick. Also, hear about not only next week's two-hour De Palma tribute, but this week's special Wednesday night episode as well. And special Movie Geek guest host Ty joins in on the fun as each of the geeks choose three criminally underrated films. Are you ready to get your geek on? Here they are, your beloved hosts, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We're very pleased to be with you this evening. And this is Jamie, and we got Jerry here. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up? How's everyone doing?
And Chris is actually on location, you might say.
Universal Studios.
Yeah, tell people where you are and where you're calling from with the show here.
Well, I'm at Universal Studios. Universal in Orlando. I'm at City Walk. I'm watching a lot of sweaty Europeans in spandex walk around. We're brushing elbows. I'm taking in all the scents. It's very nice. It's very, very pleasant.
You have a Morrissey concert tonight? That's what you're seeing?
I'm going to see Morrissey tonight. I'm going
very
to see
cool.
A sweaty European. So.
And we have a lot of Morrissey fans, actually. We have a couple of very devoted listeners who also like Morrissey.
Well, I'm one of them.
That's very cool.
That's about him.
Well, that's great. That's great. Everybody's week okay?
So far.
Okay. Well, you've read it all in the blogs and in our show announcement postings. We're going to start the Brian De Palma tribute a little bit early this week. And our guest tonight will give us all a primer on director Brian De Palma before we venture into next week's two-hour tribute broadcast. He's a highly prolific and talented film critic and essayist whose writings have appeared throughout the web on popular sites like Senses of Cinema, Slant Magazine, Rotten Tomatoes, 24 Lies Per Second, and many more. His examinations of De Palma's films rank as some of the best film writing you're ever likely to read. It is our pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Keith Ulick. Keith,
yes.
Are you there?
Yeah, here I am. Hi, how are you?
Hey, thanks so much for calling in and joining us tonight.
Yes, thank
you.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
I want to ask you this question right at the start.
Okay.
You've written such impressive things about De Palma and a lot of other of our great filmmakers, but why do you think that De Palma is such a polarizing figure? Why is there such a divide as to his merits as a filmmaker, do you think?
Oh, good question. I mean, I think one of the big things in the mainstream anyway is the Hitchcock problem, which I get into on my essay on sensitive cinema.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who hate him see him as derivative of Hitchcock, and people who love him tend to defend it, just Hitchcock being an influence and such. For me, though, you know, that's sort of like, not seeing the forest for the trees, really. It's just, it's one facet of his personality, and I think people base it mainly because I think a lot of people think of Carrie as being his first movie, kind of like I think a lot of people might think of Jaws as being Spielberg's first movie,
mm-hmm.
when they were heavily involved in things before them. And De Palma comes out of a very politically minded cinema, I think, that he's often cited Jean-Luc Godard as a big influence for him. And if you look at films like Greetings and Hi Mom, and especially Hi Mom, I think you can see Godardian traits and tactics and other things in terms of how politically minded his films are. And I don't think the political has gone away even in his thrillers, you know, even as far as recently as Black Dahlia, which I am a big fan of, where a lot of people are not, but
you're not alone.
I'm going to ask you about Black Dahlia a little bit later, but
sure.
You know, you're mentioning the kind of markings in his work. What are some of these recurring themes that seem to consume him?
Well, definitely, I think he's one of the more sexually minded filmmakers out there. In how he portrays sexuality, definitely from a straight male perspective, I'd say, and I think that really gets at a lot of people. Like when what's her name, Nancy Allen is talking to Michael Caine in his office in Dressed to Kill, and sort of is using words against him in a sense, like talking down on his masculinity by playing up her sexuality and using words like, you know, cock and everything, kind of like how David Milch does on Deadwood, except even more pronounced. You know, if you think about those words being used in 1980, even then in a theatrical setting, I think it was something very, very challenging for a lot of people to accept. So
he is very upfront with the sexuality in his movies. And I'm thinking of the opening, obviously, of Dressed to Kill in the shower with and also in Carrie. But, you know, it's kind of the Hitchcock comparison. Doesn't he kind of take the Hitchcock notions and amp them up quite a bit? I mean, he's like Hitchcock squared, you know. Doesn't he do that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what it is, he sort of takes Hitchcock's subtext in a way and makes it text. And in making it text, he then creates his own subtext as a result. It's kind of like, you know, I'd almost compare it to like the literature of Jorge Luis Borges in a way, and how it kind of is like a labyrinth in a way, and how it reflects back on itself and spirals on into infinity, I guess. I mean, you know, as long as the artist in question is, being true to themselves, and you can sense that, I think, in any movie and any work of art, then, you know, they can quote all the influences they like, you know.
Right.
So that's my belief, anyway.
Well, what do we know about his background and what kind of experiences might have informed his work?
Well, let's see. Again, he grew up, he came of age on the 60s campus, in a time of, you know, the civil unrest and everything. I feel like I'm going to be a narrator on a documentary here. so he was very active in that scene, I think, mainly through his art. You know, I mean, his activism is his art.
Right.
I think he was, the movies he saw were just very engaged with what was going on. And even now, I mean, you know, his most recent work that he's working on right now is Red Active, which deals with the Iraq War. So, you know, I mean, and apparently is shot near the region, I don't think in the region, with a cast of non-professionals pretty much, or actors who you don't necessarily know. So, I mean, even now he's not moved away from that. And I think, you know, that formative experience is very key to understanding who he is, in complement with the Hitchcock thing and several other things as well.
I think so, too. We have, on next week's show, we have the critic Armand White, who's a big champion of many De Palma films.
Indeed.
Especially Mission to Mars.
Indeed.
From what I've read. And that's a big observation of his, that the 60s activist is alive and well in De Palma's work.
Yes.
It probably informs his work more than anything else. But you made mention in your essay on De Palma of some incident that he had with his brothers that might have informed some of his suspense films anyway.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And you know what? I have totally blanked on exactly what that was, except that I know his older brother is in science, and so there's very much, if you look at there's a sort of technical wizardry to his movements, and a very much a precision, to his camera work that I think also puts people off, because in a sense he's tipping his hand as to the artifice of the films, so you're aware of them as movies very much.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think that what that does actually for me is it brings me being aware of it being a film. It actually brings me closer to it, and it's like it's another layer through which I have to gaze, you know, deeper into it.
Yeah.
At least that's how I'd describe it. You know.
Let's talk about his views of women. We mentioned it a little bit earlier, but
yeah.
I know that some critics claim that he can be misogynistic. But
yeah.
What are your thoughts on his portrayals of women, and what's unique about his handling of female characters in regard to the suspense genre?
Yeah, well, I don't think De Palma is a misogynist. You know, I go around saying that I think Sam Peckinpah is a misogynist, but I think Peckinpah's misogyny is very key to his art. So it's kind of like it's a sort of disgusting perspective that actually is dealt with very honestly in his films. So the De Palma for me is not like that. De Palma, I think, I don't want to go the feminist route necessarily of saying empowering women, but I mean I think he draws very strong female characters, women who are women in a sense, and who are not women targeted by men to kick ass. You know, basically there was like an essay I wanted to write once called "Do Women Need to Kick Ass in Order to Kick Ass?" You know, yeah. I don't think you necessarily need to see them doing karate chops and bringing men down or kicking men in the balls to necessarily, you know, say that's empowering women.
Right.
You know, I think De Palma very much does see a divide in gender, let's say, between male and female. But he explores that very deeply. I mean, I don't think you can look at someone like Angie Dickinson in Dress to Kill and say that she's an uncomplicated character. She's a very complicated character, and the fact that she's taken out so early in it, and yet you still get this like mini movie of her frustrated sexual life in a way, and more than that, you know, and just her life in general, and you know, like when she's in the museum. And she looks at the painting of the gorilla, and then I think the next thing is she's just writing down "must buy turkey" in her date book. I mean, it's not explained, and I mean, one of the things actually, he was originally going to have a voiceover, I think, over that scene.
Yeah.
I'm so glad he didn't, because you know it works so much better without it. And I actually think if you want to see the bad version of the Dress to Kill museum sequence, even though I like the film very much, there's a scene in Raising Kane where there is a voiceover over Lolita Davidovich gazing at stuff in her house, and
right.
There it just kind of doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
We
talk about this quite a lot, in that
yeah.
De Palma is our most purely cinematic director, in that I get the sense that he would much prefer to tell a story visually than be burdened with unnecessary dialogue, or exposition, or text.
Yes.
And that museum scene is the prime example of that. But there are examples of that throughout his work.
Yes.
And it is a powerfully written, well-developed role for Angie Dickinson, actually, and probably the certainly the best cinematic performance that she's ever been given. You know, and given.
Yes.
What do you think about the criticism that he's a cold director, that he's along that line, that he's more of a technician than a creator of human moments?
I think that's just people looking at the surface of things. I mean, if you can't see the life and his characters, I mean, even something like The Black Dahlia, or let's go to Mission to Mars. I mean, you know, the scene with Van Halen in space, you know, where the the married couple who were very much in love throughout, you know, or dancing to Van Halen in Zero Gravity, and
it's
beautiful.
The most optimistic scene I've seen.
Yeah, and I think it's absolutely, you know, just beautiful. And you know, I mean, I think there's room for cynicism, but I don't think De Palma is necessarily a cynical guy. I think he very much loves humanity in a way, and I just get that. I mean, how can you not empathize with Carrie? How can you not, in a sense, empathize with Gillian at the end of The Fury, or Gillian, excuse me, you know, when she blows up Cassavetes? I mean, it's that scene is triumphant, but it's also tragic at the same time. It plays on so many different levels, and I think, you know, that creates a swirl of emotions that, for some, just shuts them off.
They
don't want to feel that.
The end of Obsession also is like,
yeah.
I mean, when she, you're talking about also it's in a blink of an eye, but when she finally says "Daddy,"
yeah,
you don't get that's very and that's early on too. That's
yeah.
like very early on, and that's a very human element from him.
Well, I was talking about that with Carrie as well, because
yeah, I mean,
there's so many emotions going on. Carrie, you're horrified. Scenes with her mother, you're
yeah.
horrified. You're very emotional because Carrie, Sissy Spacek, gives such a painfully emotional performance in that. And also, there's a macabre kind of humor in the background too, because you know that Piper Laurie is approaching it as satire almost.
Yeah.
So there's all, you're absolutely right, all these emotions, and people are used to being programmed to know exactly how they're supposed to feel at this moment.
Yeah.
I don't find De Palma's films that easy, you know, that simplistic.
Yeah, no, and they're not easy, and also to bring it back to something you had mentioned about exposition, I mean, you say he likes telling films in pictures, but I also think that there are times, and there are times when it fails, like in the Raising Cain scene I mentioned, but where there is exposition in the dialogue, as I would argue that in Mission to Mars, for example, it's practically all exposition in the dialogue, but for some reason for me, and I don't know if this happens for you, in that film, in that context, in that frame, it takes on a sort of philosophical ideal in a way, in that they are trying to figure their way out of all these different problems, and they have to be exact about what they are feeling at a given moment. And it makes sense to me with astronauts that they would do that, that they would say something as simple as, you know, when your wife died back here and then and there. And I think the way he directs like that opening scene with the two tracking shots, you know, it gives a sense of the connection between people, and it gives weight to dialogue that perhaps on the page would read very poorly, but then,
right.
You know, I don't necessarily think a bad script equals a bad film. You know, it depends on, you know, it ultimately is the blueprint for whatever results from, you know, the collaboration.
Right.
I just recently rewatched Mission to Mars, and so did Jerry. You watched it last night.
Yes, we did. We watched it last night.
And I was just so struck by how almost life-affirming and positive.
Well, it's the most positive thing I've ever seen from him. I mean, even more so than the ending of Bonfire of the Vanities, which is a positive ending, the Morgan Freeman court scene where he tells everyone to go home and be good. But it is the most, I think that's why people had a problem with the critics, especially because here's this man who wrongfully has been accused of being a master of the macabre. But they were just, people just were really, I think, thrown off by this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. And, I mean, I think, again, that comes from seeing De Palma only as the heir to the master of suspense title, when really he is so much more than that. And I mean, I think that stems from an ignorance of the early political films. It stems from ignorance of his penchant for comedy as well, you know, and you know, also his extreme tenderness. I mean, like, I think it's Ohan, who's the Vietnamese girl in Casualties of War. I mean, you know, she's more than a symbol in that, but I mean, she's so flesh and blood in some way that's just so deeeply touching to me. And
that is one of the most haunting movies that you're ever likely to see, Casualties of War. But he's had, speaking about his humor, and I think it's a very special, dark kind of humor. I think Scarface is very funny, and he's actually made a big splash with the gangster picture, if you think Scarface and The Untouchables.
Yes.
How do these fit into his sense of cinema?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. The Untouchables was a big childhood favorite, and then I watched it again when I was writing the piece, and I absolutely hated it. And
really?
Yeah, I did. And I kind of, you know, except, I'll tell you what, for the, quote, Odessa step sequence, the baby carriage shootout, which I think is absolutely brilliant. But, you know, I think that both Scarface and The Untouchables are very influenced by the scripts that are the script writers who wrote them, which is Oliver Stone in Scarface's case.
David Mamet.
And David Mamet in the latter case. Now, I love Glengarry Glen Ross, and that might be the only Mamet I can really get behind 100%, but I think there's something off about The Untouchables to me, and in the way, like, Patricia Clarkson is kind of just the trophy wife and nothing more. I think Kevin Costner is kind of ill-suited to the task. Sean Connery is fun, and, you know, and Robert De Niro is fun, but for whatever reason, it didn't hold together, and maybe it's just something, you know, ineffable I can't put my finger on aside from. It just really disappointed me. But Scarface, I mean, I've watched that several times, and I think that's, like, one of the most vicious, biting, like, you know, satires of corporate rise, in a sense, and gangster rise, you know, that's ever been put to film. I mean, it's, and of course, the Howard Hawks film is great too. You know, De Palma and Stone, though, take it and put it, you know, with the Mariel Boatlift. So there's the political side, which is both their political sides. I think Stone's a very interesting filmmaker too, in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think the melding there of those two personalities creates an interesting dialogue. Whereas in Mamet, maybe it's just there's a staginess to Mamet that De Palma can't really overcome for me except in that one sequence. But I just think Scarface is so
over the top.
It's over the top and it's brilliantly hilariously over the top so many times. I mean, Pacino in that and Heat. I mean, wow. You know, the man can be give the man something to go crazy with, he can be hilarious and so on point at the same time.
Oh, we know. We did a 2-hour show on Pacino. Yeah. He's a hero.
I have a question for Keith. I have a.
You go ahead.
Regarding Scarface, do you think in some way that with Scarface he sort of beat himself to the punch with Bonfire of the Vanities, because Scarface is really a foreshadowing of what the 80s is all about. Excess, greed, and I think he covers all those themes very well in 1983, and I think just sort of like almost the movie version of Bonfire of the Vanities is almost just a footnote, really, in the end.
Poor Bonfire. I mean, you know, would that I could say it was some unsung masterpiece. I mean, it's not. I don't think it's as bad as everybody says it is.
No, not at all.
There's a great opening tracking shot. I think it is... A problem that does come up in De Palma sometimes is miscasting.
That's the film of all miscasts, right there.
And that's really a big, you know, miscast in that case. It was kind of the problem I had with Spielberg's War of the Worlds. I did not really get into that film because I thought, you know, basically Tim Robbins should have played the father and Tom Cruise should have played the survivalist, you know.
That's a very interesting point. Interesting.
So let's talk about Black Dahlia, because
you're
one of the few vocal critics who really praised that film.
Yeah.
So let me ask you why.
Okay. It's funny to go from miscasting to that, because I'm sure people would use Black Dahlia as like a big example of miscasting in his oeuvre. Well, where do you guys stand on it, if I might just ask a second?
I think I walked into it and I was at an unfair disadvantage, or the movie was, because my perception was that it would be about the case of the Black Dahlia. And I was unprepared for that almost to be a side note, because I thought the murder of the Black Dahlia, this is perfect for De Palma, you know, and it really that's the least of its concerns almost.
Yeah,
it's about how this case affects everyone surrounding it.
Exactly, and I think where some part of the problem stemmed from is that a lot of people didn't recognize that it's based on a James Ellroy novel, here is another example of a writer having a conversation with De Palma, De Palma having a conversation with the writer, even though Ellroy didn't write the script.
Right.
I think Ellroy's whole life is kind of defined by the murder of his mother.
Absolutely.
And how unsolved that is. And so his version of the Black Dahlia, the movie adheres in pretty much close to the book in certain respects, and then in other respects it deviates tremendously. But I think it's a very... It is probably the best transcription of an Ellroy novel that I have seen, in the sense that, for example, I think Ellroy is so contained within his own head and his own obsession, and that basically, you know, the mystery, there's really no mystery in Ellroy. I think he basically sets up a standard mystery, and then it just gets lost in, like, this miasma of experience, you know, it's just like, you know, people, you know, I think, what did my friend Matt say? He said that Ellroy's favorite line is, closure is bullshit.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, the Black Dahlia case has no closure in the movie, and I think one of the interesting things in the book, there's a side trip to Tijuana, and in the movie there is no side trip to Tijuana, so what happens is that everything is confined to L.A., but it is an L.A. that I find to be very soundstagey. It seems, as I said in my review, I wrote two pieces on it, one at Reverse Shot and one at Slant Magazine. I said in my reviews that it seemed like you could hit one of the standing sets and it would just topple over.
Yes.
And I think one of the telling instances of that is when they go to when Aaron Eckhart and Josh Hartnett go to interrogate the Dahlia's father at the diner.
Oh, yeah, Kevin Dunn.
And they walk out of the diner and it's a diner by the sea, and the name of the diner is Diner by the Sea. You know, so it's kind of like, again, he's tipping his had as far as the artifice.
He's
saying this is an artificial world. I think the fact that the Dali is discovered right at the corner of a limitless field, so it seems, is very telling. She's like right at the margins of this self-contained space, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think within that, there are all these people who are enacting this kind of film noir mystery and pretending to be human beings. And the only time, you know, they don't break through. I mean, the ending.
One time they do.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, go ahead.
The Elizabeth Short character in the flashbacks, in the reels.
Yes.
I think that's, and I have to say something, I think that's the most human that De Palma's been in quite some time
mm-hmm.
with her.
Okay.
I mean, she is in pain in those shots. This innocence, you see it evaporate by the last, with the film of Hilary Swank, the exploitation film.
Right.
She's very uncomfortable. This is not what she signed up for.
Right.
Right. Right.
I think most people agree too. That's the highlight of the film. Kind of De Palma as the tormentor, and you know, it's very moving segment of
the
film.
Yes, it is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting to me about the Dali is that it is a cold film, I find, but I find it cold in the Bressanian sense in a way. I don't know if you've seen Bresson's The Trial of Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
The Trial of Joan of Arc is basically like taken from her, taken from the transcriptions of Joan of Arc's trial, and it just sort of goes. It follows that, and there are some like segments of the interrogators looking in at her in the prison, and it's kind of like it's just a point by point thing of the trial, you know, and then her walking to the stake, getting tripped along the way, and everything, and then you know she's burned in the end, and then right at the end there's like this dog that comes up and looks at her and like barks at her, the flames going up, and then it just cuts to the stake and she's gone,
mm-hmm.
you know, and for whatever reason he just holds on that, and it's suddenly like emotion breaks through, bam, you know, and it's kind of like you didn't really feel it through the rest of the film. It's kind of like the whole film was a justification for this moment. And I think that's what I feel about the Dali in a sense, is that I think the ending, where Hartnett thinks he's got the answers, essentially, you know, by he's tortured, in a sense he's tortured by killing Swank, which is a big deviation from the book, and I think a very important and telling one. He doesn't mm-hmm. kill the girl in the book at all, Hilary Swank's character. But he, in the movie he does, and then he comes and thinks he'll be safe with Scarlett Johansson. You know, he sees her as angelic and everything. He sees her as the redeemer,
right,
in a way. And then in that moment, you know, he looks and he thinks he's got the answer, but then there's this call from behind, and you know, it's basically the Dahlia cut up and everything, and
right.
you know, that is never going to leave him.
Right.
And it's kind of like then when that happens, the heavenly light goes down, and everything becomes that Vilmos Zsigmond, you know, 70s gray.
Exactly.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and then she's just like, and it's a great last line, come inside.
Yeah.
Because it's not just a command to, like, literally do that. It's if you think of it, it's a sexual thing, too.
Yeah.
You know, come inside, and like, and I think the implication is we'll just live in our sin together and deny everything.
Right. What's
basically.
Also like the end of Blowout
yeah.
too. It's like,
that's exactly yeah. what I was thinking. Yeah, the screen.
Right.
That
yeah, the screen that will never go away.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You
the
know, years,
little, yeah,
years from now, Keith. The last question I have for you: years from now,
sure.
how do you think the universal perception of De Palma will evolve? What do you think his legacy ultimately will be?
It's a very interesting question. I think that my hope is that he'll always be polarizing, I've got to tell you. And maybe that's unorthodox for a critic to say who's in love with, you know, one of these artists. But, you know, I mean, I think the great ones are always argued about over time. And if you go back, I mean, you know, you can see, like, at the time Bresson was ridiculed in a lot of sectors, and some mainstream presses too. A lot of the accepted classics in the mainstream canon, or even you know certain critical canons too, were very much argued over. And
right.
I think the ones that aren't, that just sort of become, you know, the accepted classics, don't really last. I think there's always argument as far as for who and what fits into the canon. But I think De Palma really, you know, challenges people enough that. There will be a level of acceptance where he will never disappear, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let me put it that way. But I hope that he's always engaged with and talked about, you know, like in my case, for example. I mean, Ozu, everyone says, is one of the greats, and thus far I can't think of anyone who bores me senseless more. to show that I too am always in process on what I'm thinking about things. I mean, it took a while for me to come around to Bresson, and there was Diary of a Country Priest, and that just, you know, convinced me. And De Palma's been a childhood love, and that's never going to go away. And I've seen everything ever done as far as I know, anyway. I mean, I think there's like a short or two that I haven't seen yet. But it's just like, don't let the arguments, don't let the discussions stop, because they need to be there. And at the same time, if you love him, don't let the negative stuff get you down. Just if you feel it takes away something, then give what you feel is needed back. And
one of us on the show absolutely adore him. And
we thank you
so much for being
thank
a part
you,
of
Keith.
It.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
And you have an open invitation. Come back anytime and talk movies with
us. Yes, please do.
Okay, please. I'd love to very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Keith Ulick, you can find his writings. There are links to them on our blogs at Senses of Cinema, Rotten Tomatoes, Reverse Shot, like he said, 24 lies per second. Just, he's all over the web. And he's a great
I could talk
person.
To him all night.
I could too. But our guest host is on the line. He's been waiting patiently for about 10 minutes. I'm so sorry. Ty, are you there?
I am here. Hi, guys. What's up?
Hey, sorry the interview ran over, man.
No, man. It was interesting.
It's great. It's great. Ty is here for our topic of the week, where we're essentially, each one of us is going to reveal three flick picks, but films that we believe are criminally underrated. So our listening audience, in effect, gets 12 flick picks. I mean, that's unbeatable, isn't it?
That's, you can't ask for better. I mean, they might sue me for mine, or like they might, you know, delete me, but, you know, otherwise, yeah, I think it's going to be good.
So I'm really excited about this. But first of all, I got to tell you guys, everyone out there listening, Wednesday night we have a special 10 p.m. Eastern show. We've added a Wednesday night show, and I think it's going to be kind of industry-driven the way we're planning it now. But there's a new horror film called Women's Studies. It's been getting a lot of buzz on Fangoria and Joe Blow's horror movie website. It's really all over the web. They just started shooting this month. We have the director of that film, Lonnie Martin, and three of his lead actresses in the film as well, including Judith O'Day. And who is Judith O'Day, might you ask?
Back
Barbara.
Get you, Barbara.
That's who it is. It is Barbara from the original Night of the Living Dead. We have sound effects. Isn't that cool?
That's awesome. I need a drink.
You want to hear it again? Hang on. Hey, absolute silence. Hang on.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
All right.
I actually thought that was Ty. I used to do that.
Well, doesn't she say, like, Johnny, stop it?
Yeah. Remember?
Stop it, Johnny.
I used to do that all the time.
Okay. I thought it was Ty. Great. Okay.
All right. So that's Wednesday night at 10:30. We also more than likely have Spencer Garrett, who is – he's not 100% confirmed yet, but I think it's pretty safe to say he was in – Air Force One and a variety of other big, high-profile movies. He's also in this month's I Know Who Killed Me with Lindsay Lohan, as well as Charlie Wilson's War at the end of the year, which is a big film. Mike Nichols directs, Tom Hanks, Julia Roberts. It's a big film. So we'll get the scoop on that. All right, let's get started with our flick picks. Let's go around in a circle. We reveal one at a time. Chris, on location in Orlando, why don't you give us the first one?
All right, my first pick, criminally underrated movie, is Andrew Niccol's Gattaca.
Good choice.
Wow.
It is, I loved it from the time it came out. It didn't get the greatest reviews in the world. I know Roger Ebert championed it, and that's kind of why I went and saw it.
Right.
And it really holds up. I just watched it about a month ago. You know, it's a sci-fi movie. It's got Jude Law, Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman. Gore Vidal is in it. Alan Alda has a really funny performance as this futuristic gumshoe. And this movie, not Truman Show, is the reason that you still keep hearing Andrew Niccol's name come up every couple years.
Amen to that.
Movie.
Yeah.
And he hasn't quite followed through on it, although I like Lord of War a lot. But Gattaca is the reason you keep hearing his name come up, and I love it.
That's a good choice. Ty, give us your first one.
Okay. My first pick today is Before Sunrise.
Oh.
Richard Linklater.
Yeah.
Good choice.
This was kind of like one of those word-of-mouth movies. Not many people went and saw it in the theater. Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy.
Yeah.
I thought it was awesome, man. It's very dialogue-driven.
Yeah.
In case none of you have seen it, which I'm sure all of you guys have seen it, but for the listeners, it's, you know, Ethan Hawke is on holiday, and he runs into Julie Delpy on the train,
mm-hmm.
and she kind of throws out a challenge, you know, why don't you get off the train with me, you know, take a risk.
Right.
And he does that, and they spend the day together, and it ends very abrupt. I mean, it just ends, and you are wanting more. You don't know what happens to the characters. They make an agreement to meet up, and you don't know if they ever do that. And the sequel is just as good, if not better.
I like the sequel a lot, too.
Yeah,
yeah,
I thought it was awesome.
It's interesting how the first two picks have been Ethan Hawke films.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a good point.
Richard, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, actually, Linklater, he used them again in one scene from Waking Life, and it almost seems like the same
right.
couple
yeah.
from Before Sunset. They're in bed having this discussion about dreams. You know, anyone that's seen the movie, I'm not going to go into the details of the discussion because, it's, you know, you've just got to see it.
Right,
but
right.
It's almost like the same couple, and it's because they really do have unbelievable chemistry together.
You know, I like films like that are just kind of slice of life. There's nothing heightened. Because if you look around, I saw a movie like this similar to that called Quiet City at the film festival earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one of those movies where you can tell people what it's about. You know, it's not plot-driven. It,
right.
Anyone that asks what it's about, you say it's about that couple just sitting right over there. I mean, you don't know what kind of lives they have, what kind of conversation they're carrying on. And I like movies like that.
Yeah.
And this one is definitely like that, Before Sunrise. I haven't seen the sequel.
Before Sunset, it was shot in one continuous shot. I mean,
really?
The camera never broke. They didn't have takes. I mean, if they screwed up, they had to start from the beginning of the movie. That's how it was shot.
Oh, really?
So,
like Alfred Hitchcock's Rope with a romance?
Yeah.
So, Jerry, what's your first flick pick?
Okay, I can see. God, you guys really went over the top here. I feel like the guy just barely comes in with his homework done, you know.
It's not Meatballs 2, right?
No, I didn't do that, my friend. I'm going to 1979 Winter Kills with Jeff Bridges, Anthony Perkins, John Huston, Sterling Hayden, Eli Wallach, which is a fictional take on the Kennedy assassination and the conspiracies, and it sort of combines all the conspiracies. Very underrated film, never really, a lot of trouble with it, but I have to say it belongs in the same category as The Parallax View and 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, I love those films, especially Parallax View. But
yeah, and also I'm going to say it belongs with the movie that comes a couple of years later, Blowout. It definitely is one of the great paranoid conspiracy thrillers that where John Huston plays a Joe Kennedy-like figure. Jeff Bridges, like you would say, is probably the Teddy Kennedy part.
That's a great pick. Who directed that one?
I don't know his other work, William Reichert, but it is based on a Richard Condon
uh-huh.
novel, The Manchurian Candidate and Pritzi's Honor.
Right.
And it is just a great, great thriller. And for people who like, especially for people like JFK, they should run out and rent this.
Right, JFK's dead. But you know
what? I meant the Oliver Stone movie. Okay.
Oh. You know what's interesting is every one of those 70s paranoia movies are just great.
And they hold up very well.
Yeah, 70s conspiracy paranoia. And obviously the time called for those kinds of movies with Watergate and all the scandal and you know, and I think that we're due for another round of those movies with Big Brother issues. And
I hope so.
Yeah. My first pick is a Spike Lee joint. It's Summer of Sam.
Awesome movie.
Obviously it deals with David Berkowitz and the Summer of Sam murders that occurred in New York. In the 70s it was, right?
Yes.
But more than that, it's about the paranoia and the frenzy that it caused in the neighborhoods and where everyone suspected everyone else, and it changed and altered and ruined a lot of lives in the process. But it's a dynamic film. No one can direct like Spike Lee. I mean, just electrifying movie.
Great cast too.
Oh, incredible cast. Adrian Brody and John Leguizamo and Jennifer Esposito and
Vera Sorvino.
On and on and on. Mm-hmm. And it has an orgy scene. So really, even if the movie wasn't any good.
I always thought that John Leguizamo was going to start getting great parts after that movie because he is fantastic in it.
Mm-hmm. And, yes, then he had Carlito's Way a few years earlier, and he was Benny Blanco, you know, the high-profile roles.
Right, and he never goes away, but like in Summer of Sam, there's a scene where they're coming back from the orgy, and of course he and his wife have both been, you know, unfaithful to each other, and it should be all good because they both went into it knowing they were going to do that, but he just turns to her. You can see him fuming. He's like, "He fuck you better than me?" He delivers this like fury that's so hilarious.
And so it plays over the top, but that is exactly how you would react in that situation.
Exactly, yeah.
That is the male reaction to that sort of thing, which
right.
I've been in many orgies, and I can speak firsthand.
Great. We got Peter North on the line. That's great.
Okay, Chris, give us your second one.
All right, my second pick is Billy Ray's Shattered Glass.
Excellent.
Which is a movie that just kind of came and went, and it got great reviews, but it didn't get a very wide release. It wasn't all over the place.
Right.
And I can see why it wouldn't be successful in the theater. You know, it's about this guy, Stephen Glass, who was a reporter for this magazine, The New Republic, basically he was just making his stories up. He wasn't even plagiarizing. He was just making his stories up.
Right.
And but it doesn't unfold quite that easily. You really get to know this character, and you, as an audience member, don't want to believe that he's capable of, you know, this horrible thing. And it's got a great cast in it. Hayden Christensen, who, if anyone thinks of him only as Anakin Skywalker, they need to see this movie.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, he turns in a fantastic performance.
And Peter Skarsgård as well.
Skarsgård, one of my favorite actors. Yeah, he is great in it, too. He's
and that director who also did Breach, which
is Billy Ray was,
a movie about another enigmatic deceiver.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a special gift with those kinds of characters. I mean, very influenced by 70s work in Breach, I would say. But Shattered Glass is amazing, and it's not an easy movie. It's not an easily defined character. You can't put that character in a box and figure him out.
Right.
No,
And that's what I love about that movie. It's challenging. You know, you don't watch it. It challenges you.
It's a very intellectual movie, too, but it's a very accessible intellectual
mm-hmm.
movie. You know, it's not something that you're bored with. It's actually kind of a thriller, almost, because you're so involved with the character.
Right.
Yeah. Ty, what's your second choice?
My next pick is 1996 Primal Fear with Richard Gere. And Ed Norton, who this was his first big movie,
yeah.
First coming out movie.
Yeah.
And the twist at the end is just, oh my, awesome. I thought, I didn't see it coming at all. I don't know if you guys did.
Yeah.
But
no.
Another great cast.
We went and saw that movie together, didn't we, Ty? I think
we did.
Did. Yeah.
We did, yeah. Andre Brower is in it.
We were both blown away. I was blown away by the ending of that movie, too. That's one of those
Laura Linney's in that, too, isn't she?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Frances McDormand also.
That's right.
It's a Gregory Hoblit film, I think.
Yes.
And
he did a lot of TV.
Yeah, he made
that was
Selma Hayek
movie.
Stephen Baldwin movie with Fled.
Mm.
And then he did
Hearts War, too.
He did Fallen, Fled.
Frequency.
What kind of F title is he going to do next? I just...
you know, I watched that the other day, just kind of going over it again, and Ed Norton's performance, how he was so awesome in it. When you're watching it, you're thinking he is going to be something to watch in
right.
the future.
Right.
And I remember thinking that same exact thing about Scarlett Johansson when I saw The Horse Whisperer.
Yeah.
She was amazing
yeah.
in The Horse
yeah.
Whisperer. I mean, we could talk all day about Lost in Translation, but
right.
Yeah, and I think Edward Norton knew that was his shot. He said, you know, I've got... This might be a kind of potboiler movie, but I've got a great chance to show off my skills with this one and make a splash, and that he certainly did. Jerry,
I'm going to go with a childhood favorite of mine from 1975, John Milius's The Wind and the Lion. And the reason I bring this film up is because a lot of people, you say, you know, everyone says, oh, Sean Connery's greatest role is The Hunt for the Red October, or even The Untouchables. And I have to really beg to differ and go back to the 70s when I think he was at the height of his career with not only this film, but The Man Who Would Be King in Robin and Marion and The Next Man. But The Wind and the Lion is just a great adventure film, and, you know, talking about things that don't date, the film hasn't dated at all. It owes, and speaking, John Huston's in the film, and it owes a lot to his films, The African Queen,
right,
and Heaven Knows Mr. Allison. And here we have Sean Connery plays the Razuli, who has kidnapped. He's a, what do I want to say? He's a Moroccan chieftain in the nomads in the desert, and they kidnapped Candace Bergen and her kids, Mrs. Mm-hmm. Petacaris, and hold them for ransom. And the United States government, under Teddy Roosevelt, has to figure out a way to get them out. And playing Teddy Roosevelt is Brian Keith, which I think is probably one of his best roles and probably one of the best presidential portrayals I've ever seen in a film.
Right.
And he's great, but it's just, it's got a rousing soundtrack by Jerry Goldsmith, and also from Milius, who I know in later years, you know, hasn't done much, and he definitely tends to go right wing.
Yeah,
but
he's
here,
a crazy man.
Well, I don't know about that. I actually have a sort of a, I actually know him through someone else. I wouldn't, you're kind of half right. But he, in this film, gets it right. In Farewell of the King, he's channeling David Lean. In this one, and I guess because he's working with him, he's channeling John Huston.
John Huston, right.
And I would, you know, if you're going to channel someone, that's the one you channel.
Okay,
and
so your first two were Winter Kills and Wind and the Lion. Ty's got Before Sunset and Primal Fear. Chris, you've got Gattaca, and what was your second one?
Shattered Glass.
Shattered Glass, exactly. I've got Summer of Sam, and my second one is a remake of The Thomas Crown Affair. It's a John McTiernan film, Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo.
She is incredibly hot in that movie.
She is fantastic in this movie, and I think it's such a stylish, fantastic role. She's never been better in a film. She's never had a better character. And the movie is just completely breezy and enjoyable, and you get such a buzz from it. I mean, it just kind of elates you. And
Tim, you don't think that her character in Rocky and Bullwinkle should be better?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, but I
mean. yeah, I'm not going to touch that comment. But that movie is fantastic, and it's an example, like Cape Fear, of a remake that far outshines the original. I know that the original got a lot of praise, the Norman Jewison original with Steve McQueen, but I didn't quite like it.
The poster was better than the movie, actually.
Yeah, I think this film is, the remake is everything that one wanted to be and claimed to be.
And Dennis Leary's awesome in it, too.
Oh, Dennis Leary has a fantastic part in it as well, and Pierce Brosnan's playing exactly the kind of role that he should play.
And that's another movie like Primal Fear that's got, it builds up towards this ending. You're thinking,
right,
how are they going to tie this together? How is the ending of this movie going to pay off? And Thomas Crown Affair, just the ending blows the rest of the movie away. It's like, oh, okay, all
right,
right, that's how they're going to do it. Okay.
Right.
And it really pays off.
Okay, Chris, let's hear your third and final flick pick.
All right, my final flick pick is The Music of Chance with Manny Patinkin and James Spader.
Oh.
The movie, I don't even think that the movie is on DVD. I've looked for it online, and that's a real shame. But if you live near a video store and you still have a VCR and they might have a copy, if you live, you know, in a big city that's got some place like Kim's Video in New York City, I know, has it, this is a great movie. It's just about these two guys, Manny Patinkin and James Spader, who are, Manny Patinkin picks James Spader up hitchhiking. He's a poker player, and they happen to get involved in this little private poker game with Charles Durning and who is the little guy in the movie? I can't remember.
I forget.
Joel Grey. It's Joel Grey.
Oh, okay. That's right.
The stakes of the game are that if they lose, they have to stay on the property and build this wall for them, and that is what happens. And they end up having to build this wall. They're basically held prisoner by these two rich guys, and they just get to know each other and spend every day together. Mm-hmm. And it's got a great dialogue, just interesting little, like we were talking, slice of life about two people just getting to know each other at different points in their lives, and it's great.
It's a terrific movie. I remember seeing it on cable many years back, and it's great because you have no idea what's coming.
No.
You can't predict this film. It surprises you as it goes along.
And it's one of James Spader's best performances, actually.
I would go with that, yes.
I think so, too, and he is such a fascinating actor. He's great in everything, but he never watches movies. He especially never watches his own films. And his motivations for doing movies, I remember him saying, somebody asking him, why did you do Stargate? And he said, well, I read the script, and I just thought it was awful. And I thought, how are they going to do this? You know, he's a very, very, very offbeat actor, and I've enjoyed him in everything he's done.
Why he works so well with William Shatner, I think.
Exactly. We have a call, and I believe it is probably our guest. We're going to bring him on for a couple of minutes so he can plug a special event. Jerry, do you want to tell us something about this guest?
Well, he's called in before, but he's my friend Francis Abbey, who is a very good friend of mine. I've known him for a little while, over a couple of years. We used to work with him, and he is an aspiring screenwriter, filmmaker, and actor. He has acted on the Buddy Jackson web episodes. And he is a prolific screenwriter, and he is going to tell us about one of his scripts that is going to get a special reading in New York City.
Okay, let's hear all about it. Francis?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing? So what's happening with your screenplay? What's going on?
Well, the screenplay is called Pencil Tucky. It's a comedy, a character study about a guy named Larry who's like the world's worst actor. And it placed fourth in the 2006 Slam Dance Screenplay Competition. And
oh, fantastic.
One of the prizes was this stage reading. So they're going to do a stage reading 2 weeks from tonight, July 29th, at the Bowery Poetry Club in Manhattan.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a huge deal. I'm really excited about it. And any listeners in the New York area, please come out. It's free, 4 to 6 p.m. You can get more details on their website, BoweryPoetry.com.
So how does the reading work? Have you seen the actors that have been assembled to read it? Or?
I've assembled a few actors. I'm still looking for actors. So if you got any actors, they can contact me. They can get in contact by going to the website.
Is Paul gonna be at the reading?
Paul Busetti will be there, yes.
All right.
Who was one of the filmmakers on How Did You Lose Your Soul, Sweetheart, which I was acting in. He will be there, and
you
he's
are
actually
great,
passing out flyers right now. Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, give us the date and time and location one more time and how they can find you on the Internet.
Okay, it's Sunday, July 29th. It's going to be at the Bowery Poetry Club in Manhattan from 4 to 6. It's 308 Bowery. That is the address. And if they want to get in touch with me, you can email me at francis.abbey@yahoo.com. If you have any questions regarding the reading, just go ahead and shoot me an email.
Okay, and your profile, too, is on the homepage of Movie Geeks United, I believe.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah,
so yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We got you covered, man.
Yeah. All right, fantastic.
Have the best of luck with
that. Good luck, Francis.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, man.
Take care.
You Bye-bye. Too. Thanks.
Okay, so anyone that lives in that area, make sure you check that out. Ty, we're ready for your third and final flick.
Okay, I went a different direction with my third and final pick. This movie, interestingly enough, was written by James Frey. And James Frey is the author of A Million Little Pieces, that controversial book.
Yes,
he lied about.
Yeah.
And this is a comedy, which I love. I know Chris likes it a lot. It has David Schwimmer and Jason Lee in it, called Kissing a Fool.
I remember this one. Okay.
I almost picked this movie, Ty. I almost picked it.
Every time I watch it, I howl. It is just hilarious all the time. And Jason Lee and David Schwimmer bounce things off each other. They have such great chemistry on screen.
They really do.
So what's with Jamie? What do you think?
What's the basic premise? I remember seeing this years ago, and I laughed my ass off. But
David Schwimmer is a local broadcaster, sports guy for WGN.
Right.
And he, you know, is always dating these different girls. And Jason Lee sets him up with Mili Avital. Mm. And Jason Lee is a writer, and she is his editor.
Mm-hmm.
And they start dating. David Schwimmer and Mili Avital start dating, and then Jason Lee falls in love with her, and it's about what happens with the two friends and the girl.
who
they kind of do a King of Marvin Gardens thing where they switch. You would think that Jason Lee would be playing the wise ass, you know,
womanizing,
but it's the other way around. David Schwimmer plays that part and pulls it off amazingly. He's actually very, very funny in this movie, whatever you think about him from Friends.
I remember being very taken by David Schwimmer in the movie and how funny he was.
Yeah.
Bonnie Hunt is in it, and she's great.
That's right, but I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a
good, surprising pick. That's a good one. Jerry, what's your last one?
My last one, all right, let's go to Art Linson, longtime De Palma producer, but also directed 1980s Where the Buffalo Roam with Bill Murray, which is perhaps my favorite Bill Murray movie, but it's also more important because it introduced me to the world of Dr. Hunter S. Thompson.
Huh.
And I still think this is one of Bill Murray's best roles. And Johnny Depp even went to go interview Bill Murray before he did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and Bill Murray was like, look, I still haven't gotten Thompson out of my system, and you're not going to get him out anytime either. But it is it's a little dated, sure, but it's all the mannerisms that we've come to know about Bill Murray through Broken Flowers or The Life Aquatic and Mad Dog and Glory, it's all there.
Art Linson directed this one?
Art Linson directed this.
Is this the only time he's gone behind the camera?
No, he also did The Wildlife with Chris Penn, the sort of unsuccessful sequel to Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yeah.
But this also probably contains, I think, Peter Boyle's best performance as his lawyer, Laszlo.
Yeah. Peter Boyle has done some, he did some incredible work.
Yes, he always did.
Yeah, if you think...
Jerry, do you prefer Where the Buffalo Roam to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas? I mean, I know they're not the same piece, but they're
totally
both
different.
They're
two entirely different tones.
Yeah.
I mean, one is really just the adaptation of, if you can call it that, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is like adapting Naked Lunch, an impossible task. But
I actually think that it's one of the best adaptations of a supposedly unadaptable book. I think it's genius.
Oh, it is. Terry Gilliam, whatever he does, you know, is I'm right there with him. And so maybe with the exception of the Brothers Grimm, but
How about what's the last Tideland?
Oh, you didn't like? Oh, Tideland is sort of the Canadian equivalent of Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I enjoyed Tideland too. I got to say. But
yeah.
It's
bleak.
It's a good picture because I think that the movie does hold up, and you can see a lot. I actually think that Johnny Depp learned a lot from Bill Murray as far as performance goes. Obviously, they're both very close to the real Hunter S. Thompson, but Bill Murray turns in a pretty good performance in that movie.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
Yeah. Okay, my last flick pick is one that was actually a popular movie. It made a lot of money, but I think it wasn't appreciated the way it should have been as one of our great comic campy masterpieces. And I think it features a performance that is probably one of the top comic performances I've seen in 10, 15 years, and it's given by John Voight. And I'm talking about, of course, Anaconda.
Oh, my God.
Are you serious that big?
I am serious. It is a fantastic comedy, and it seems to me that John Voight gets it, and nobody else really does. But John Voight is hysterical in that movie. And,
but it's not billed as a comedy.
No,
I thought it was about John Holmes, so I was disappointed when I saw it.
It's not billed as a comedy, and it might be inadvertent. That's what I'm saying. But I think that out of everyone on the movie, working as an actor in the movie, behind the scenes, John Voight got it. And it shows in his performance. It is an amazingly funny performance.
It's actually got a good cast, too.
Ice Cube,
Eric Stoltz. Jennifer Lopez, Owen Wilson is in it.
Eric Stoltz.
Eric Stoltz. That's right.
But I'm fully in Jamie's boat, no pun intended, that John Voight steals the movie, and you
yes,
can watch it again. Forget about the snakes, although the snakes are funny too now, actually, if you watch the movie, but they're not as funny as some of his lines are so quotable, and Jamie quotes them all the time, you know, funky blood, things like that. Right.
Anaconda, hold you tighter than your true love. And they give you the privilege of hearing your bones break before the power of his embrace makes your veins explode.
My goodness. How many times have you watched that?
You know, it's been years since I've seen it. But it just stayed with me because that performance
seems that way.
Stays with me. Rewatch it as a comedy. I'm telling you guys. So
I agree. I agree with you, Jimmy.
Let's review the choices. Jerry picked Winter Kills, which is definitely a movie I'm going to have to find and look up.
Yeah.
Wind and the Lion and Where the Buffalo Roam. Chris has Gattaca, Shattered Glass, and The Music of Chance. And Ty has Before Sunset, Primal Fear, Kissing a Fool, and I have Summer of Sam, Thomas Crown Affair, the remake with Pierce Brosnan, and Anaconda. That's quite an assortment of films there, guys.
Yes, it is. Anaconda. Whoa, that really caught me off guard.
Well, I was kidding with Jamie that he was going to say, live from New York, it's Barry Manilow. His flick pick.
This is coming from the guy that chose Meatballs last week. She's shocked by my Anaconda.
I am shocked by it, because I was picking it as a way to ease the tension with, you know, between Pacino and De Palma. I just wanted to pick something lighthearted. I mean,
right.
But Anaconda, whoa, I mean...
That's as lighthearted as it gets. I think
for you, yes.
That's a camp classic. All right, guys, it's been great. Chris, enjoy your concert.
Yeah, have a good time, man.
Thank you.
And we'll talk at you later. Ty, you're welcome back on the show anytime, man.
Thanks for having me, man. It was a lot
of
fun.
Thank you for being on. Thanks.
Join us for
no problem
picks anytime. It's been great fun.
Thank you.
And I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
That's Ty. You can find him on our MySpace. Drop him a line. Tell him how much you enjoyed his flick picks this week. Jerry?
Yeah.
We're out of time.
Okay.
So we're going to play off the closing music with one more little blurb about De Palma, and we'll see you guys
Wednesday night.
Yeah. Wednesday night, 10 p.m. We got some exciting guests, and of course, next Sunday's 2-hour tribute to De Palma is a must-listen to as well. So. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you, and good night to everyone.
Good night, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
The Black Dahlia. Femme Fatale. Mission to Mars. Dressed to Kill.
Snake Eyes.
The Fury.
Mission Impossible.
Carrie.
Carlito's Way.
Raising Cain.
Obsession.
The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Phantom of the Paradise.
Casualties of War.
The Untouchable.
Sisters.
Body Double.
Scarface,
High Mom,
Blowout,
the Brian De Palma Tribute Show, a special 2-hour event, Sunday, July 22nd at 6 p.m. Eastern.